Article 3. The operations, therefore, I had expected, actually physically, I think, to have moved a bit further on the ground towards Stanley. But, of course, part of that had not been possible because there had been the loss of Atlantic Conveyor, and therefore the helicopter effort was not available to support the operations that we'd hoped would be available, and 3 Commando Brigade had started the Great Yomb. And obviously that is a slower method of movement. But I don't think things had developed very differently from what I'd expected in any more radical sense than that. My orders to General, rather in those days, Brigadier Thompson, had been to establish himself ashore, had been to push forward whilst maintaining balance and his position, obviously, securely in the landing area so that we could reinforce through him. And to push forward to the best of his ability with the forces he had towards our final objectives, and to go and seek a battle which he would demonstrably win. The phrase I actually used in the orders I gave were to seek to establish that dominance over the enemy, which was going to enable us to build up by breeding success on success and so on. And of course the Battle of Goose Green had just happened, and that did, I'm sure, begin establishing that. In fact, I think I would say more than begin. I think it must have established very clearly in the minds of anyone, their side, our side, service or civilian, that if there were going to be battles between anything like equal numbers, we were going to win them. So I think things at that stage had developed pretty well along the lines that I would have hoped, but not as fast as I might have hoped. But I don't think on arrival, think of that as a disastrous point, though timing and speed was a very essential element in the whole affair, and I think perhaps might be the next subject we would talk about. Right. Now, the timings of everything were, of course, based around the sustainability of the fleet. Once the carriers and their escorts started operating, there would obviously be a limited and finite time that they could sustain operations before the need for maintenance or repair to various vessels. And in particular, of course, since we depended so much on the support of the Harriers to give us air cover and to defeat the Argentinian Air Force, we had to have a situation where the carriers could operate until we could get air cover established ashore. Now, we had calculated, as far as I recall it, on an expectation that the carriers would be able to sustain air operations fully, both of them, for about a month from when they began, and therefore we must plan on trying to have a capability to sustain operations ashore, from ashore that is, air operations from ashore, at the end of a month, in case one of them had to be withdrawn for some sort of maintenance or something. And one of the things that, therefore, was coming down south was the matting, the engineer plant, and all the other equipment that was necessary to set up a Harrier operating field, strip, whatever you like to call it, ashore in the beachhead area. That was in Atlantic Conveyor and was lost. And that meant, obviously, an increase in the pressure to get ahead as far as time was concerned. Secondly, the thing that was also lost in Atlantic Conveyor was three quarters of the heavy lift helicopter capability, three out of the four Chinook. And a number of other helicopters were also lost, Wessex 5s. Now, of course, that loss made it more difficult to move ammunition from the point where you get it ashore to the point where the guns are going to want it. It made it a much more laborious process because of using smaller aircraft with a smaller payload, and therefore all the add-on problems that it isn't just that each flight is a smaller payload, but if it's a smaller aircraft and a smaller payload, it has less fuel, so it has to refuel more often, and it's therefore less time flying, and all the other things that build into making it a much bigger logistic problem to lose the bigger aircraft. And that meant that if we were going to have less artillery ammunition capability, we were going to rely more on the naval gunfire support. But the naval gunfire support came from escorts, and the escorts were the vessels that were taking a hammering both from the enemy air and from the weather. And I believe I'm right that by the end of the operations, all the escorts had suffered damage of one sort or another, battle or weather damage. And again, those vessels were going to have to come out to do maintenance problems, and indeed the very guns themselves that they used to support shore operations needed maintenance. They need to have their barrels changed every now and again, and that's not a thing you can do just overnight at sea. You've got to go get away and do it. So that was another reason that we were going to have to get on with completing the operation. The dilemma was that the loss of Atlantic... Oh, no, perhaps let me put in the third element of that. And I'm sorry for the untidiness in the recording. The third element was that Atlantic Conveyor had all the tentage I had taken south. Now, tentage may not seem very warm stuff, but it was shelter. Theoretically, there was the tentage for 5,000 men on board Atlantic Conveyor. And that tentage would at least have provided some shelter where you could rest people, where you could get them out of the weather for a bit. It would have enabled various logistic people to work in more efficient conditions and so on. It would have provided shelter perhaps for some of the prisoners of war, whom we often could not provide much shelter for. So that was going to be important, and again, without that, it made it the more vital that we get on because of the weather problem with winter coming on, and no matter how well trained your troops are in coping with Arctic conditions, inevitably they will deteriorate if left in the bad weather. And throughout this operation, we were up in the high mountains, deliberately so, because we were better able to cope with it than the enemy were, and because we could come at him from a direction which hopefully he would not expect us to come from if we did it from the high mountains. And therefore we were more subject to the difficulties of the weather than the enemy were in that sense. So again, that is a third reason why we must get on with the operation as quickly as possible. And therefore we come back to the dilemma. And the dilemma was, of course, that the loss of those helicopters had hugely reduced my ability to get on with it fast. And so, there we were. How were we to get on with this thing quickly? we had to find another method of getting ourselves forward to do that. And then we had the problem of what method we would use to move troops forward. 3 Commander Brigade, by the time this developed to the crunch point, shall we say, had really got 3 units forward into the mountains. 42 Commando was up on Mount Kent and in the high mountains there. 45 Commando had marched across and followed them and gone up into the high mountains. And 3 Para was on their northern flank, slightly lower hills, but nevertheless up in the hills and things, having marched also. And therefore those 3 were forward and pressing the enemy. But 5 Brigade was being landed further back. How to get them forward? Well, there was, of course, the question, first of all, that, without wishing to touch sensitivities unnecessarily, one did have to face the fact that 3 Commander Brigade and the parachute battalions had been doing a great deal of very hard physical training. They were physically extremely hard and extremely fit before they even left the United Kingdom. And they had done a lot more of it on the way south. And marching was inevitably less of a problem than 4 battalions which had been for many months on London duties. Nobody's fault, fact of life. But it did make it much more difficult for them. Secondly, 3 Commando Brigade had a much better logistic backup than 5 Brigade. And I'm not just talking in terms of the logistic regiment that it had. I'm talking about within the units where they had Volvo over snow vehicles. Not very many of them, but at least a few of them that could carry some of the vital radio sets and things. And all that sort of stuff we had to get for 5 Brigade forward. Leaving aside any of the tactics of why we put them, why I moved the brigades to where I moved them, we had, therefore, this problem of moving 5 Brigade and its men and its materiel forward to close up with the enemy and to catch up, if you like, with 3 Commander Brigade, who'd been there, after all, 8 days longer than they had. And this, the solution to this, came down to moving them round the southern flank by sea. As I say, I'm not really going into why the southern flank. There were tactical reasons for that, and we can discuss them later if you'd like. But the logistic point, really, was how to encompass that move and get them forward as fast as possible. Now, from my angle, I could either trickle them forward using LSLs and landing craft utility and the like, and indeed the Falkland Island vessel Monsoonan, which had been sunk, or not sunk, but damaged in Goose Green and had been recovered by 5 Brigade, and the Navy had sent some people down to get it working again, and all that sort of thing, to try and move them forward to catch up. One could use anything from an LPD, which, after all, is a major vessel of 10,000 tons or more, which would take a lot of troops for just an overnight trip. One could use LSLs, which would take many fewer troops and would not, of course, carry landing craft and so on. And one could use, as I said, these LCUs, which would take a company each, and they had 8 of them. Not that we could spare all 8 necessarily for that sort of move, but one had that method of moving them either the whole way or part of the way. And the timings and distances were such that one might have at best done the whole move in about one night if one had used the LPDs and some of the LSLs and so on, and if all had gone well, got them delivered and been out of it and back again by the morning. But that was pretty unlikely. Or one could, you know, get somewhere in between that and the simply trickling them round one load at a time in an LSL or whatever. And in fact, I wanted initially to think in terms of moving them almost all in one. I think our initial plan was a two-night do. But the danger there was that there was a danger of losing one of these big ships, even a danger of losing one of these big ships whilst still loaded with a lot of troops. And, of course, detaching oneself from any emotional worries about it, it could have a colossal impact politically, if you like, with a small p, on the thing to have a very large loss, having got away with the initial landing. And that might have put enormous pressures on us, on the government and everything else, to bring things to a halt suddenly and inappropriately at a time when militarily one was thoroughly unbalanced and very exposed with a 50-mile LSC without adequate ability to maintain it and so on, and an imposed stop. And so in the end, we did it by a sort of mixture, and the LPDs did go so far around and drop off the LCUs and move people that way. Some of them had very difficult moves. The Scots Guards had an appalling move one night in bad weather, exposed in LCUs before they got ashore, though they did in fact get ashore safely. We had some of those sort of hitches which always happen in war, and people didn't meet up with other people when we tried to move the Welsh Guards the next night, and we weren't able to complete it satisfactorily, and A, that caused a delay, B, that caused the abandonment of further attempts with the LPDs because we'd done it two nights running. And the danger to the LPDs, I perhaps should have mentioned, which I hadn't, was that by then we had got intelligence reports that there were probably Exocet moved to a shore launch position in the islands. And of course that, if you were caught forward and exposed, was what would have been a very grave danger to such a large target as that. And of course, as we know, subsequently they had indeed got them ashore, and in the end they hit Glamorgan with one of those Exocets. Although in the event it didn't seriously incapacitate the ship, it just wrote off her helicopter and put that and the helicopter deck out of operation. So, in fact, the trickle went on, and it was at the end of that trickle, the last two companies of the Welsh Guards, who were caught in Galahad in that air attack. Now, I'm not going into, at this point, the balance of, you know, air defence ashore and things, but I think in many ways on that move round to the south, if one's going to be dispassionate about it, we were lucky to get away with only that loss. On the other hand, maybe I think it is certainly arguable that those two companies should have been ashore and not still in the ship. Again, I'm not saying that to be unkind to the senior Welsh Guards officer on board or to criticise him unduly. His background was obviously as an army officer, and I believe that the army in general thinks in terms of armoured vehicles in Germany, for instance, where the right thing to do would be to stay in your vehicles if you're hanging around waiting and not get out and expose yourselves. And he had been at that stage brought to a point which was not the delivery point. He was at Fitzroy and not at Clough Cove, where his commanding officer was expecting him. His information was that on shore the bridge on the track between the two had been blown, and that therefore he'd have a long, I think it was about 14-mile march round the edge of the cove, and that therefore he would be delivering to his commanding officer two companies of tired, wet, one might even say possibly exhausted soldiers. As far as he knew, the commanding officer might be wanting to employ them for a battle that night, and therefore he must cosset them and bring them to delivery in good condition, and so wait until the LCUs should arrive and move them. And, you know, you can argue that as a reasonable viewpoint. A marine's view, I think, would be a different one, but then we're accustomed to the amphibious setting, and I think that our way of looking at it is you see a shoreline, you damn well get on it quick, because you are very vulnerable in a ship, and that's the way we think. So I think that actually was, in my view, what led up to their still being on board at that time, together with the other many factors and the chaoses and the difficulties which are always inevitably there in war. But I do think, though it was a great shock at the time, and though I felt it myself as a considerable shock, and was worried about it, one, from a morale point of view, two, from a point of view of what effect it might have back home on, you know, attitudes and so on, and the support for the government's determination to go ahead and complete the operation, which I was quite sure in my own mind was the right way to go. The important point, in fact, militarily, was the delay which it would cause to the completion of the operation, the whole business of speed. And I did, in fact, at the time, I think, guess come calculate that it was going to cause us a delay of about 4 days. That's certainly what I reported to the Commander-in-Chief, that I thought would be the delay. In fact, we recovered some of that time, and I think the actual delay in the event was about 2 days.
One issue that's sometimes been raised about the Falklands campaign has been why it was that it was decided that it was necessary for an attack on the Darwin Goose Green area.
Yes. The Argentinian garrison, of course, by the time we made the landing, and it had been like this for some time, I think, had settled, basically, hadn't it, into the vast bulk of the Argentinian occupation force was in and around Stanley, for very obvious reasons, that Stanley was the key, and it held the airfield and the communications centre and the only real population centre, and was the nominal capital, and therefore obviously seen as the key point. And there were three other garrisons, all of them, as I recall, and certainly we had broadly the idea that they were all about 1,000 or so strong, at Port Howard, Fox Bay, and Darwin Goose Green. The Darwin Goose Green one had a handy airstrip, and was, of course, on the flank, quite really reasonably close on the flank of any route we might have along the southern side of the main part of East Falkland in closing up on Stanley. Port Howard and Fox Bay were behind us, but were separated by the Falkland Sound from where we were. I think I would say that the view on all these was that all of them could pose some sort of threat, but that the Fox Bay and Port Howard ones, it was a reasonably remote sort of threat. As far as Darwin Goose Green is concerned, I was not actually tied up in the decision-making about the timing or anything of attacking that particular garrison, because it all happened while I was still at sea in QE2. But I would think that I would have felt extremely uncomfortable at trying to conduct operations, feel free to conduct operations against Stanley with that threat so close on my flank, uncleared. And it is close. I know that certainly once we'd got established forward, we could move aircraft reasonably freely the other side of the mountains from it, and we could certainly go round by sea on the outside of it, as we did many times by night, without that garrison being able to do very much about it. But they could get from there up into the Sussex Mountains area, which was the southern part of the rim of hills around San Carlos, and that was only perhaps a dozen, 15 miles from them. And that inevitably would interfere and pose a considerable threat to our base logistic area. Indeed, even after that garrison had been removed, I retained back in the base area, much to their disgust and chagrin, one unit, in fact 40 commando, to guard that area against the threat of attacks from a variety of possible threats, including, for instance, helicopter or waterborne, because we could never be sure what the assets they had available were, forces from either Fox Bay or Port Howard, which could have been a very grave disruption to our operations, either by attacking with swimmers and that sort of thing, HMS Fearless, where the headquarters was, or any of the supply ships in San Carlos, or indeed the administrative and logistic base area in Ajax Bay. And they also could have been operated in coordination with or in support of an airborne operation from the mainland.